You are listening to the Turnipair Baseball Podcast. Let's go! Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Chris McClain. You can find us on Twitter at TurnipairChris and on Instagram at Turnipair Baseball Podcast. You can listen to us on iTunes, Spotify, Podomatic, Google Play, or Apple Play. If you like this episode and you're new to our show, go back in the archives and check out our past interviews. Go ahead and hit that subscribe button as well. If you really like the show, give us a 5-star rating and leave a review. On today's show, we welcome in DJ Snelton, pitcher for the Tampa Bay Rays. DJ's story is absolutely incredible. He is proof that social media can be an absolutely incredible thing, a powerful thing, and something used in a positive way. We'll get into that here in just a second. But first, let's talk about last week's show, or at least the show that we came out with this past Sunday. We had Detroit Tigers prospect, top 30 prospect, and outfielder Bryant Packard on the show, and the reviews were fantastic. Well, I was the first one to review it because I was the first one to listen to it. Roseanne Sapia was the host, and she does a fantastic job. Her and Bryant's conversation was fantastic. I thoroughly enjoyed it, but the feedback from the listeners has been great as well. So go back and listen to that one. Bryant's story, pretty cool deal. So grew up in Greenville. He lived all over the place. His dad was in the Navy, so they lived all over the place. Eventually settled in Greenville. He played at East Carolina right there in Greenville, Greenville, North Carolina. And then he ended up being drafted in the 5th round by the Detroit Tigers in 2019. He's already ascended to the top 30 overall prospect, or in the top 30 list of their overall prospects. And the Tiger system is one of those ascending farm systems. They've got some talent in their organization. He talks about his time playing for Team USA. They had a chance to go play in Cuba. They played against Cuba and, of course, Japan. Very cool to hear those stories. And he talked just really, his whole story is cool. He talks about his why. It really gets you thinking, right? The importance of family, of just life in general. And so he gets into that. There's also some moments of just absolute hilarity. While I was listening to Roseanne and Bryant talk, there were several occasions I was laughing hysterically myself. So go back in the archives to last week's show. When you're done listening to this one, go back and listen to last week's show with Bryant Packard. You'll laugh, you'll think, and I think you'll be entertained by his story. He's a really good storyteller as well. But this week, let's get into this week's show. We have DJ Snelton on the show. DJ, cool guy, one. He's from the Chicagoland area where I grew up as well. His brother played in my college ball in my hometown, Valparaiso. So a lot of connections there. We share that bond. But he went to Lakes Community High School in Lake Villa, Illinois. It's a northern suburb of Chicago. He ended up playing his college ball at the University of Minnesota, but he had a choice going into his senior year or his freshman year of college. Do I sign with the Padres, who picked him up in the 30th round, or do I go play for Minnesota? He made the smart choice. He played 3 years of college ball there, and then eventually he was drafted in the 9th round by the San Francisco Giants. He debuted in the big leagues in early 2018 against the Dodgers, pitched an inning and a third. Unfortunately, had some injury issues and didn't really perform quite to the level that I think he thought he could, or obviously the Giants did. They designated him for assignment. He ended up with the Orioles for the rest of that season. Last season, he pitched for the Chicago Dogs, an expansion independent league team, the American Association. And then he went into this offseason with a couple options. One, he could go back to school and just focus on school, or he could sort of relearn how to pitch, figure things out, figure out what he can do to get better. And he did. And this is really the story here, it's not about his everything leading up to it. It's about this. And it's so absolutely incredible. You want to keep listening to the episode to hear it, how he won, dramatically improved his overall pitching performance and picked up velocity, but also how he took his career. Basically, he took it by the balls and said, let's go. and ran with it. Just an incredible story of perseverance, of dedication, of drive, truly inspirational story. And here he finds himself in big league camp with the Rays. Fantastic story. I could sit and tell you about it all day long, but why do that when we've got DJ on the phone? DJ, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah, well, you're our first Tampa Bay Rays player. I can't believe 70-some episodes in, and we finally made it to a Rays player.
Well, I'm glad to be the first. Very honored.
Yeah. Well, we're excited to hear your story. You're right now, you're driving up from Fort Myers down in Florida, probably heading back to the Port Charlotte area. But, man, yesterday was your first outing. Got back on a major league mound in a spring training game. Faced three batters, got them all three out. How did it feel?
I felt amazing. You know, it was very very interesting perspective moment for me. You know, you don't know what it's going to feel like when it's been a while since you've been on one of those mounds. And after having the last crazy calendar year that I've had, you know, I just felt incredibly blessed to be back out there and, you know, competing in a major league uniform again.
So you knew a couple days in advance when you were actually going to take the bump, but talk about, you're in the bullpen warming up. What's going through your mind as you're warming up, knowing, hey, I'm about to get in the ballgame?
Just thinking about getting ready to get back into the ballgame, or just getting into the game in general. I was more or less thinking about how many times I've been up and down in my career in terms of, you know, getting ready to go in the game. And it was a lot more settling for me because it made me realize, you know, I've done this quite a few times, and, you know, it's just kind of, I wouldn't say it's like riding a bike, but more or less it just felt natural.
Yeah. Well, that's a good thing, right? If you get out there and it feels weird, then it's like, uh-oh, what do I do now?
Right. It would have been a lot more worrisome had I went out there and felt like I'd never done it before. So I'm glad to be out there, and it felt familiar and everything felt good.
So did you feel, you know, sometimes people, when they experience something big, you know, this getting back has to be a big moment for you. Do you feel more of a sense of relief, or is it a sense of joy?
Honestly, the biggest thing that I can remember is wanting to take a nap afterwards with the adrenaline coming back in and having to get to pitch in front of fans and stuff like that again. You know, it kind of gets your blood going a little bit, and it makes you think about other things besides what you've worked on for the last 5 or 6 months and getting back out there with somebody in a box. I know the second that I was told, you know, that I was done with the inning and I was good to go and I could do whatever I was doing, I got through my lift, and then all of a sudden, the second I got home, I was like, I could fall asleep right now for 2 hours and I would be very happy.
Did you?
Very briefly, yeah. I took a nap and then realized if I took that nap that I was going to be up till 2 a.m.
Yeah.
Up early in the morning, so I can't do that.
Yeah. That's always the problem with those afternoon naps, is they really cut into your actual sleep time. And then the weird thing is, you end up the next day, you're even more tired because you're up so late the night before.
Right. So it's kind of like you're going into a bank and then you're surprised that there's nothing left once you dip into it. You know, it's kind of, I shouldn't have done it, but I'm kind of glad it worked out because I felt pretty good today.
Good. Well, that's good. It's a big day. Your girlfriend flew into town, so you've got a week or so with her. It's important to be refreshed for that time. So let's take it back when you were a kid growing up in the Snelton household. At what age were you introduced to the game of baseball? And do you remember how it was that you were introduced?
Yeah, absolutely. I was 7 years old when I finally got onto a team. You know, I always played catch with my brother when I was younger, and my dad always had me playing catch too. And from the moment I put on the uniform, my dad kind of approached it as an adult, and he told me, like, hey, if this is what you want to do, we're going to take it seriously. We're going to compete. And, you know, if you want to play baseball, this is meant to be fun, but I also want you to treat baseball the same way that I want you to treat life someday, you know, put in your work. And so from a very young standpoint, I was always taught to kind of get the work done first before anything else.
Did you understand that as a kid, or was that something that took you a little bit of time to sort of figure out what he meant by that?
Of course not. I wanted to get Dairy Queen after every game.
Yeah, heck yeah, man.
It took some time.
What's your go-to Dairy Queen order?
Ooh, the Oreo Blizzard.
Was that Absolutely. That was your go-to as a kid?
Yep, the Oreo Blizzard, without a question.
Am I weird that I don't like traditional, like the black or the chocolate Oreos? Is that weird?
I don't think it's weird. I mean, everyone's got their own specific tastes. I mean, I know my girlfriend Lexi doesn't really like pizza all that much. I mean, I think she's kind of weird for that one. But...
I mean, that, yeah. Now, is she from Chicago as well?
No, she's from California. Actually, she's from the Sacramento area.
Okay. I don't know much about California pizza, so maybe that's why. It's just not a thing. I don't know.
I still don't know much about California, and I was in and out of there for 6 years.
I was going to say, you were out there for a while with a couple different teams.
Yeah.
Up through the Giants.
Yeah, I was up there for quite some time.
Yeah. So you grew up, you played baseball, you started playing at an early age. I know you played golf as well. Was that something you picked up at an early age as well?
Yeah, I always played golf at a young age too. My dad played golf professionally for 4 years, and still he owns a synthetic turf company, and he has a replica of hole 17 at TPG Sawgrass in his front yard. So golf has always been a major thing in our lives, especially as a family.
Wow. So do you still play today?
I try to. To be honest, I don't think I've been on a course in probably a year or two, but I know every time I go out, I always have a really good time.
So I guess the answer to this question is probably no, but are you planning to play it all this spring with some of the guys on the team?
I would if I had my clubs, but yeah, I don't think I'm going to be able to. Plus I have family coming in for the next few weeks. It's all timed up. So Lexi's here for about a week, and right as she leaves, my mom and stepdad come in for probably 2 weeks, and then my dad comes in for a week as well. Then before you know it, spring training's over. So spring training is kind of a good opportunity for me to spend time with my family and my girlfriend, because once the season starts and you're on the bus every 3 days, and it gets more difficult.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Totally. So baseball and golf, what other sports did you play as a kid?
That was it. Well, I guess technically floor hockey, but going to school at the University of Minnesota, I couldn't really say that because people didn't deem that a real sport.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. I have family in Canada, and I remember as a little kid going to visit them up in Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario, Canada. And they were down with the fact that I played baseball. That was cool, right? Like, baseball's big there too.
Yeah.
But they were like, hey, let's go play hockey. And I was like, well, I can't. They were like, what do you mean you can't? I'm like, I don't know how to skate. And they're like, oh, God, who are you? Are you sure you're part of our family? It was kind of weird. I felt.
Yeah, that is a very overlooked thing. I wanted to play hockey when I was younger. My dad played in a men's hockey league team for like 19, 20 years. He grew up playing pond hockey. And so every time I told him, yeah, I want to play hockey, he's like, no, you're going to get leveled right off your skates. No, you're not playing hockey.
Yeah. So. Now, you're a big guy now, but I think I heard in an interview, you said when you were younger, you weren't very big.
No, I was not. I mean, I was big, but in a different sense. I was more big from a horizontal standpoint. I was
okay.
Puberty hit me pretty well when I was in junior high. I was probably 5'6" and 190 pounds. I was pretty thick. And then at one point through high school, I went from being 5'8" to 6'6" in a matter of about a year.
And did you lean out at that point as well?
Yeah, I definitely leaned out at that point. But I could definitely tell it took some time to get used to that, because I felt like I was tripping over my feet every other day and tripping upstairs. And it was to the point where my dad actually had to get a personal trainer for like 3 months just to teach myself how to be a little more coordinated.
Yeah, I was going to ask. I mean, I remember, I think I grew at a normal rate, so it wasn't like I didn't have that really awkward stage. But I had some friends who had just significant growth spurts. And you know, you get out on the basketball court after, you know, 3 or 4 months of a big growth spurt, and they were like different athletes. Like it took them a while to kind of figure their body out. And obviously you had that same period. Now, were you big into baseball at that point? And how difficult was it to play baseball going through that significant growth spurt?
I think that was the transitional point to where I started getting really serious about baseball.
Okay.
You know, I always wanted to play recreationally as a kid. I saw how much fun everybody was having, and you know, we all had a good time and made a lot of friends. And right around junior high, going into that high school point, is when I started to try and play travel ball. And I kind of have this, it's kind of like a genetic gene with my family, where when we're told that we're not able to do something or we're physically not able to do something, we kind of dig down deep and we want to prove the world that we can do it. So in junior high, when I started trying to play travel ball, I actually got cut from pretty much every team I ever tried out for. It was to the point where my dad had to make travel teams so that I could make the team. And So I think that was the point where I started getting irritated because people were starting to talk about how good at baseball my brother was and that I might not be able to fill up to his shoes. And that kind of hurt me to the point where I was like, yeah, I'm just going to be the best that I can be at baseball.
Wow. So I imagine you look back on some of that moment. You still sound like you look back on that moment or those moments, I should say. You ever want to go back and talk to some of those people and just be like, hey, what's up, dude? Look at me throwing in spring training.
When I was younger, you know, I was that way. I was a little vindictive, and, you know, I always wanted to show people, yeah, look where I'm at now. But it's to the point where I've gotten back to loving playing the game so much that I don't feel the need to rub it in anybody's nose anymore. I just want to go out and, more than anything, prove to myself that I can still compete with the best of them.
Well, I love what you said about your family has that gene where if you get told you can't do something, it just means you're going to dig in deeper and try harder. And I mean, if that's not more like obviously your actions are a lot more powerful than your words, and your actions over the last, you know, call it baseball or season or year, whatever you want to call it, has absolutely proved that to be the case. And when you said that, I smiled a little bit. Like I love that story, which is what drew me to reach out to you. So at what point did you got in high school, you know, started playing travel teams, you played on your high school team, you had success in high school, obviously good enough you were drafted out of high school. At what point did it start to become where you were more of that elite player, or at least a player good enough to be drafted out of high school? When did that start to click for you?
Were you asking when that happened?
Yeah, I guess at what point through that late middle school into high school did baseball start to click for you, where you became that elite player in the area?
I was a bit of a late bloomer. I would say going into my senior year is kind of when it happened. My junior year was kind of, you know, after my growth spurt and everything started to slow down a little bit, and I started gaining control of myself. And then I played for this club team that, once again, my dad was the coach for, called the Kenosha Indians. And that summer, I ended up just piecing a lot of things together. And I think I'd thrown like 60-something innings. I had a 0 ERA, and I was like 9 or 10-0. And it was against other competitive club teams. And from there, I went from having no Division I interest to getting 5 to 7 letters in the mail every day and having a scout call probably once every 2 to 3 weeks. And then it was still kind of fringe of where I thought I was going to be, because my brother played Division I baseball, and all I thought about was, you know, I want to go Division I too. That was really cool. And then this showcase that still goes out to this day, and it's a lot bigger than it was back then, the Super 60 showcase in the Midwest. I went and pitched at it. I hadn't really been on a radar gun ever, like not at least not in that platform. I didn't know how hard I was throwing, and by the end of the bullpen, I stood up, and about 14, 15 MLB team scouts came up to me with questionnaires asking me to fill it out right away, asking for my contact information. And that was kind of when it hit me, like, oh, wait, this could be more than college. You know, this could be a career if I do this well.
Wow.
You know, I think that was the clicking moment.
So you end up getting drafted. You get drafted in the 30th round by the Padres. Now you've got options, right? So you get drafted, you could sign with the Padres. At that point, had you made your decision to, I mean, it's June, so you probably made your decision to attend Minnesota, right?
I made it actually towards the end of the summer. So I was what a lot of people called the draft and follow, which is where they draft you in that 30th round. Because back then they didn't have that, that signing bonus cap of $100,000 after the 10th round. So you could pay somebody more than that without a penalty or like a luxury tax or whatever it is.
Right.
And I went out and played for these teams all the time. And the scout that had been paying attention to me the whole time, Jeff Stewart from the Padres, his son is actually Brock Stewart, pitched for the Los Angeles Dodgers, I want to say, a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
He's a big league guy. And we would go to these occasional like showcase tournaments where like probably once a month, his dad would call and say, like, hey, we actually need a pitcher on this Bloomington Gold team if you want to come and throw, and this would be an opportunity for me to watch you. And, you know, so it was kind of one of those situations where I started to add pressure to myself as a high schooler, thinking, like, oh, my God, every outing could make or break my career. And then I just kind of realized, was like, you know what, if this is how I feel about the game right now, I'm 18 years old, I'm obviously not ready for this. College is probably in the cards for me, and that makes way more sense.
That's, I think that's a mature thought, because I've heard, you know, I've read other interviews, both where you're actually talking, it's an audio visual, or just in written word. And you're a guy who's analytical, and I can relate to that as someone who sort of looks at every moment, maybe not so much in a vacuum, but maybe thinks about the pressure of the moment, or the what that moment means on the larger picture. Is that something that still impacts you today, or have you sort of figured out how to put the moment aside and just be in the moment?
It makes perfect sense. I think, honestly, back in the day when I was younger, being an analytical person was a huge detriment to me. And I think as I've gotten older and more mature, I've kind of learned how to sift through that thought process. And I think it's become a huge strength for me now, just because understanding, you know, the kinetics of pitching and stuff like that, and coming from somebody who grew up playing golf. Golf is a very analytical sport in terms of mechanics and making adjustments in the middle of a game and things like that. But at a young age, it's really hard to sift through all those thoughts. So as I've gotten older, I think it's been something very beneficial for me, because it proves to have a little bit of a self-efficacy in terms of being able to go out there, and if I'm struggling with something, I can make the adjustment instead of not knowing why this is happening to me. So I think as I've gotten older, I think it's really proven to be really useful.
Yeah, that's great. So you get drafted, you've got Minnesota on the radar. What ultimately was it that led you to go to Minnesota versus all the other schools, and obviously the draft choice, the options you had?
Well, I had a couple of decisions to make. I went to a junior college. I went on a visit over there. I went to a small school, the University of Evansville. I took a visit there before I went to Minnesota. And to be honest, when I first showed up to Evansville, my first thought was, you know, my brother went to a small school. He went to Valparaiso. There was only like 4,000 students at the time. Evansville wasn't much bigger or smaller. And, you know, I wanted to have the same experience as my brother. And my dad kind of made me hold on and say, hey, listen, just visit a larger school, go experience that, and then tell me what you think. And I just remember showing up into the city of Minneapolis and seeing the Twin Cities and seeing the campus life and seeing all the facilities, talking to the head coach, John Anderson, and back then, you know, Todd Oakes, the pitching coach at the time, and Rob Hornacek had just won the NCAA Assistant Coach of the Year Award. And I just remember being absolutely stunned by all of them. And it was from that moment, I was just like, you know what, I have to do this. I have to go here.
Yeah. I mean, playing in the Big Ten, that's for a Midwestern kid, the Big Ten is it, right? That's pretty amazing.
Yeah. And on top of that, you know, them having the Big Ten network, you know, I wanted my family to still come be able to see me play games and, you know, be within a reasonable distance. And if they couldn't make it, I didn't want them to feel pressured, because some of those games were televised too. So it was just kind of a nice thing for everybody, including my own family.
Now, you mentioned Valpo. I have to go back and talk about Valpo for a second. We've already established that that's where I'm from. So you probably spent some time in Valpo going to watch your brother play. What do you remember about, as they call it, the beautiful metropolis of Valparaiso?
I mean, honestly, I liked it, but I'm a very sentimental person, and understanding that my brother had the time of his life in Valparaiso when he was playing there, it grew a soft spot for me. You know, as I got older, I went back to it. I'm like, oh, it's, you know, it's an aged town, but I really enjoy being there, because it makes, like, I always get to hear my brother's stories of the things that he went through when he was on the team. And it's always got a soft spot or a special place for me.
Yeah, that's funny. Valpo, it's good old Valpo. I remember as a kid, I used to go to the baseball camp there. I don't know if you remember Ron Kittle.
That sounds very familiar. Kittle, you said?
Yeah, Ron Kittle played for the White Sox back in the 80s. And I think in 1983 was the AL Rookie of the Year for the White Sox. The guy just hit bombs. That's all he did. He just hit bombs. And he would hold a baseball camp at Valpo University when I was a kid. And I remember going to those camps. It was a Christmas camp. And the lasting memory, I don't remember anything I learned at this camp except Ron Kittle would show up wearing Zubas, which are amazing. And he's just a thick dude, right? I mean, just powerful, thick, strong guy. And he would go, and I remember we would go in like, oh, I think it was like the wrestling room, but they would set tees up in there. And he would always get on the tee, and he would sort of do his tutorial, and he would hit.
Yeah.
And the sound that the ball would make, or the bat and the ball would make, was unlike anything I had ever heard. And you're in this room, it's echoing, and it was just this loud thwack, thwack. And the ball would just go flying off the tee, it would smoke the wall. And it just, all of us were mesmerized by this giant man. And yeah, that's my Valpo baseball memory, is Ron Kittle's baseball camp. He basically just came, hit off the tee, collected his money, and that was it. I don't remember him doing anything else.
That's really fun. It is funny to see those athletes in person for the first time. You never realize the caliber or the size of the athletes that actually play in Major League Baseball until you're standing in front of them.
Yeah. Well, he was, and I think at this point he was retired, but still, I mean, he's a big, strong guy. If you can hit baseballs on the roof of Old Comiskey, you've got to have some power. He had some lower body power for sure.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, like, even after a lot of those players retired, you still know when you're in the presence of a former major leaguer, too. There's just a certain posture or size or way about them. You just see them and you know.
Yeah. Oh, he definitely had a swagger about him too. And I mean, he still does. I follow him on Instagram, and, you know, he posts pictures of whatever he's doing these days, hanging out in his yard in his garage. He's still got that ball player swagger to him, so it's pretty funny.
That's great.
So, and we'll get to the kind of the whole your professional career, but I'm curious, you know, if you could look back if you could go back and talk to that kid that went to college, right, that turned down the draft opportunity, that went to college. What advice would you give to kids? Not maybe not so yourself, but or if you could go back in time, what advice would you give to a kid who's going to college, who's maybe late in high school right now, about just the prospect of potentially playing professional baseball?
Well, honestly, I think the best advice that I would have given myself or any person that was in my position at that age was to just go into the process with a little bit of humility. I think one of the things that I did as a younger athlete is I started to get a little cocky and I thought I had everything figured out. And especially growing up with the mechanical background that I had from my dad and my brother instilling mechanics in me, I thought I had all the answers and I just thought I had to pick off a platter what I needed to do to become a better baseball player. And I mean, nothing shows more or less like how much progress you can make when you close your mouth and you open your ears and you listen to the advice of other people, because I mean, that alone this off season is what changed, you know, everything for me in terms of my own career.
Yeah.
So I would give that advice to, you know, my younger self. I would tell him just to, you know, shut up and listen.
So you mentioned this off season. Is that sort of when it clicked for you, or was it a slow evolution?
It was a slow evolution, but at the same time, in terms of, you know, a chronological order of my career, yeah, I would say that was the clicking moment, because I had realized, you know, I just finished a full season in independent baseball playing in Rosemont, and I didn't have a single phone call for any teams wanting to sign me. And, you know, within a calendar year, I was in the big leagues the year beforehand. It was kind of like an earth-shaking moment of, you know what, maybe I don't have the answers, because clearly nobody's calling and nobody cares what I did, even after becoming, you know, pitcher of the month in the American Association. And that's when I kind of realized, like, you know what, I need to make myself marketable. I need to make a change. Nobody can help me with this in terms of selling myself, but I'm going to go out and reach out for help and, you know, mechanically find a way to reinvent myself a little bit.
Yeah, I want to come back to that. Let's put a pin in that part, because I want to come back to, I think there's a lot more that I sort of jumped the gun a little bit, but I want to come back to that part, because I think that's
sure.
that's such a big part of it. But so you get drafted. You get drafted in the ninth round by the San Francisco Giants. Talk about draft day for a second. How do you consume the draft that day, and how do you ultimately find out that you were selected by the Giants?
Well, I still think of that as the longest day of my life because it was day two of the draft. And one of the things that a lot of college athletes go through is that they're told that they're going to go in a higher round than they're actually going to go. So, you know, I came in with the mindset of thinking like, oh, I'm going to get drafted somewhere in the third to fifth round. You know, I had a really good season, low 2 ERA. I flashed a 95 or 96, which in today's age is a little different. But back then, you know, consistently touching 95, 96 was a very marketable thing.
Right.
And I remember sitting there, you know, the second round went by, the third round went by, and so on and so forth. I think finally by the sixth or seventh round, I got a phone call from an organization or two, and they're like, hey, if we grab you for slot money in this round, will you take it? I said, yes. They said, okay, sit by your phone. And then all of a sudden that went by and they never called back. And at that point, it had been like 8 hours. And I just remember sitting on the deck, silent, everyone's waiting for my name to be called. And I just couldn't handle it anymore. So I looked at my brother and I threw his glove to him and said, hey, let's go play catch. Went and played catch in the backyard, talking it out, trying to calm myself down. And finally, I was like, you know what? I can't do this anymore. I need to go take a nap. So I tried to go to bed, and then all of a sudden I heard everybody screaming on the deck, and I realized that I didn't hear my own name get called.
Oh, no.
So I just walked out. I walked out, and I was like, who got me? And because I thought it was going to be the Twins, because the Twins had called right beforehand, but one pick right before the Twins that year was the Giants. And I remember finally finding out that I was going to be in the San Francisco Giants organization. I get a phone call from Luke Pelletti, the scout at the time, and he's like, hey, I'm sure you just heard, you know, we're really excited. He's like, I gotta be honest with you, you know, we didn't get to watch you that much this year, so we're kind of going into this very excited because we've heard really good things, but, you know, we want to see what you can do. And in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, oh, great, I just went to an organization that didn't watch me.
Yeah.
So, but it ended up being a blessing in disguise because it just kind of gave me an opportunity to prove myself and who I was. Get to climb a very challenging organization because they had a lot of talent. And, I'll always have them to thank for getting my foot in the door for professional baseball.
So you had a lot of big milestones with the Giants organization. Obviously, they drafted you. You progressed through the system very nicely. In 2017, you get selected to pitch in the Fall League. And then you're added to the 40-man roster shortly after that. The 2018 season starts, and very early on, you have an opportunity to you get called up, and you get to pitch in the second game of a doubleheader. Let's go back to that sort of moment in time. How did you find out you were being called up to the big leagues?
Well, I was actually, that day, I was working on building a guitar for one of my teammates at the time, Chase Darnode, and I realized that I forgot one of his parts. So I actually hopped on my moped and went back to my apartment. And when I went back to my apartment to grab the part, I looked that I had a missed call from Dave Brundage. And I just thought, oh, God, did I miss a meeting that I completely forgot about? Like, am I about to be in huge trouble? And I called him back right away, kind of panic-stricken. And he just says, hey, I'm trying to find you. You know, you're going to the big leagues. We have a car here waiting for you. You need to get back here. Like, you got to go. And I remember just hopping on my moped, just screaming with excitement, like as I'm heading back to the field. And I'm thinking, like, all right, that guitar can wait. I'm about to go through something crazy.
Yeah. A couple things there. One, I've got like five different places written down here to talk to you about guitar. So we're gonna come. I want to come back to that. You build guitars. I think that's awesome. But you said you rode a moped. Was that your moped, or was that like a team issued thing? Was it the host family? Like, talk to me about the moped.
So the moped was actually an electric scooter that I had bought off of Amazon. It was the Razor EcoSmart, and it was the only scooter that I saw on there that was under $500, but had a little seat in a basket.
Nice.
And I remember everybody was giving me a hard time, saying like, "Oh my God, you got a seated scooter with a basket? That's so dumb." And then people started hopping on my scooter when I wasn't looking, riding it around the parking lot, and then everybody thought it was, like, the coolest thing ever.
That's always the way those things work, right?
Yeah, and unfortunately, I didn't get to keep it after the whole DFA process because it was in Sacramento, and, you know, everything was such a blur with that whole process. But I think one of my old teammates, Stephen Okert, ended up getting to keep that scooter because he ended up moving into that apartment.
So when you've got all your stuff with you in Sacramento, do you literally pack everything with you and send it to like go to San Francisco, or does it some of it stay back? Like, how does that work?
Oh, I didn't have the time for that. Honestly, I just grabbed my baseball bag. I went and played that game. I stayed at a hotel that night. And then when we found out after that series that we were going to be on the road, they actually gave me a vehicle at the ballpark to drive back to Sacramento and grab some of my things so that I could hit the road with the team.
Wow. So talk about the actual outing. I mean, just the experience of being in the big league clubhouse and being on a big league mound, pitching in front of a big league crowd. What was that like for you?
It happened so fast. I didn't process it until after it was over. You know, I showed up. I showed up. They asked me what size jersey I was. And I mean, I grew up with small, medium, large, or XL. So when they asked me if I was a 50 tall or a 52 long, I had no idea what they were saying. So they had to start giving me jersey after jersey until we found one that fit, and not only fit, but like actually contoured to my body. And after all that was done, they're like, hey, does that feel good? I was like, yeah, this is incredible. And they're like, all right, great. Hey, oh, by the way, if Brandon Crawford gets these two RBIs, you're in the game, so you should probably warm up. And literally, I just straight to the bullpen, warmed up, all of a sudden, two-run RBI single, and I was in the game.
Wow. So you have your opportunity with the Giants. You make your big league debut, and then, you know, shortly after that, they designate you for assignment. The Orioles end up claiming you. I think they designated you in at the end of May, right? And then June, the Orioles claim you. I read you had talked a little bit about earlier that season or earlier that spring, you had some shoulder soreness. You know, how much did that play a factor in just kind of the overall performance or kind of the way the Giants viewed you? I mean, how much did that play into it?
It played an extremely heavy factor. That winter, it was kind of a short turnaround going from the fall league back into my first big league spring training. And unfortunately, that was a year that I kind of got hit with this really nasty flu bug that basically had me in bed for 10 days to 2 weeks.
Wow.
And I tried to go back into my return to throwing program as if I had been just a single day. I got too aggressive. I felt the twinge in my shoulder. And I didn't think much of it. And I showed up to spring training. Somebody told me I was throwing 86 to 88. And that was kind of when I hit the panic button. And it's always going to be one of the biggest learning experiences for me because I should have taken my medicine and I should have approached it more urgently and said, hey, listen, my shoulder doesn't feel good. But, you know, it was my first big league spring training. I didn't want to disappoint an organization I've been with for 6 years. And, you know, it's just something that I'll always look back on saying, like, I wish I had spoke up.
Yeah. So how long did the shoulder bother you through spring training and into the season?
It pretty much bothered me the entire year. It got to a point where I got fed up with myself after I'd been DFA'd. I showed up to the Orioles organization. I got DFA'd like 4 or 5 days later. And then I was still consistently not throwing the way that I'd wanted to throw. I couldn't get the ball down in the zone because I was scared to let it go. And it got to a point where I finally told the trainer, I was like, hey, listen, I need help. I genuinely need help because it doesn't feel right. I don't feel good. I don't feel like I'm competing the way that I can compete. I don't know what to do. And they just said, like, hey, all right, fine, we'll get you a doctor. They brought a doctor, and the doctor just said, listen, this man's shoulder is completely atrophied. It's not that the shoulder muscle is weak. There just is nothing there. So they shut me down for 4 or 5 weeks. I rehabbed. It came back for a few outings. It felt a lot better, but it still wasn't the same. And by the end of the year, I just kind of realized, like, all right, I need to take 3 months and just do nothing but build my shoulder up.
Yeah. So 2019, last season, you go to camp with the Orioles, and you pitch through spring training. And then after spring training, they release you. You end up signing up with the Chicago Dogs of the American Association. New franchise, new to their expansion team, if you will, in that organization. What was it like going from, you know, affiliated ball to the Chicago Dogs? I guess talk us through kind of mentally what's going through your mind as you make that transition. And are you going there I guess my question is, when you go there, are you going there to say, you know what, I'm really not ready to hang up, I still want to play baseball? Or is it like, I'm going there, I'm going to do everything I can, I'm getting back to affiliated ball?
I didn't know what I was going through at that point, to be honest, just because, you know, I got released at the end of spring training. I was praying that the team would pick me up. But realistically, at that time of year when people get released, it's a very dangerous spot to be at in your career because most people's rosters are already set. And I had a lot of emotional things to work through. You know, I was upset with everything that was going on and where I was, you know, a year later. And I kind of pitched through a lot of emotions, and it was just kind of the only thing that I knew at the time was, you know, pitching. So I kind of came into it with a chip on my shoulder thinking, like, I'm just going to perform so hard here that, and I'm just going to try to perform so well that there's going to be no choice but to get back into affiliated ball. But it was a major transitional change for me in terms of understanding, you know, affiliated baseball culture to independent baseball culture. And there was a lot of learning experiences to be had from that.
So you played with Carlos Zambrano, which is...
I did.
People in Chicago were really excited about. That was sort of like, hey, the Chicago Dogs have an old Chicago Cub, and oh, by the way, he's going to hit. What was it like playing with Carlos Zambrano?
Well, I had a poster of him in my bedroom, so that obviously was really cool to see him there. I just remember the first time I saw him was when we showed up for our physicals for the team, and I walked through the other side of the door at this medical center where everyone was doing the physicals at, and he was just standing there in regular street clothing, and he just said, hey, I'm Carlos, and I was like, yeah, I know. Trust me, I know who you are.
So did you grow up a Cubs fan?
I did. I grew up a Cubs fan, north side of Chicago.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that you grew up with you had a Carlos Zambrano poster in your room. The room that I'm in right now is, there's four things hanging on the wall. One is all the major league ballparks, and I scratch off the ones I've been to. The three other things are, two of which are front pages of newspapers with the day the Cubs won the World Series. And the other one is a ticket stub in the front of the Chicago Tribune for a baseball game that I went to in Milwaukee when Carlos Zambrano threw a no-hitter.
Oh, no kidding. I was at that same game.
Were you really?
Yeah, I was. I remember because I was trying to take a picture on my first cell phone I ever had. My dad was like, get a picture. And it was a full count. He threw a changeup. And I remember as I went to take the photo, the guy in front of me threw his hat up in the air, and I got a nice picture of that guy's hat.
Oh, my gosh. Now, was this the last out of the game?
Yeah, that was the last out of the game.
I remember.
And, I remember getting in the car that day, and I told my dad, I was like, Dad, I'm not going to school the next day because Ted Lilly's going to throw a no-hitter. And he's like, you're going to school, son. And I was like, I want to see this game. Well, you got to go to school. I'm sitting there in history class, and the teacher asked if we should put anything on the radio, and I said, can we put the Cubs game on? And right on cue, the guy goes, and Ted Lilly into the seventh inning with a no-hitter for 16 consecutive innings, the longest in Cubs history without giving up a hit. And I'm just covering my head in misery thinking I could have been there.
Yes. So I live, as we talked about, I live in Milwaukee now, and I went to the game. Originally there was going to be four of us that were going to go. The night before, I had a big bags tournament, cornhole, whatever people want to call it, at my house. And we decided that at that thing, hey, we're going to go to the game. We got four tickets. One of the guys drank too much the night before and decided, you know what? I'm not going to go to the game. I'll just stay back at your house. So he stayed at my house and we went to the game and he missed the no hitter. He was so mad at himself.
Oh, I couldn't imagine. Yeah. I would have been so upset too.
Well, then the next day on Monday, I went to work. I should have been, you know, I was like you. I wanted to go to the game. A couple of my buddies went to the game and they're texting me. They're like, dude, he's got Lily's going to throw a no hitter today. I'm like, wow. Unbelievable. Yeah. Just crazy. They almost had back to back no hitters. No hitters for 40 or so years. And then all of a sudden, almost back to back.
Yeah, it was incredible. I believe that was my senior year of high school. So that was 2009 or 2010.
I'm not close enough to be able to see the date, but yeah, something like that. I know they played the Astros. That's all I know.
Yep.
I didn't hear any garbage cans banging. That hadn't been created. That hadn't been invented yet. So they were, no comment.
I know. I was wondering if that was going to get brought up.
I won't ask questions. I know I've talked to a few other guys who have said our organization has asked us to not comment publicly on it. So I'm not, I won't even talk about it anymore. So
I appreciate that.
Yeah, no problem. So does a guy, do you go to a guy like Carlos Zambrano and ask him for any advice, or is it just, you know, what is that?
I think we ask some advice here and there, but one of the things that a lot of people failed to appreciate was, so a lot of the stigmas that people had on Carlos Zambrano was that, you know, he was emotional and, you know, he's very passionate, and he was one of the best teammates I ever had. You know, he was very, a very responsible teammate. He was always looking out for all of us. He took care of us whenever he could. You know, he was a very religious man. And actually, it was really nice to see that side of him, because a lot of people, what you see on TV or what you hear on the radio sometimes doesn't match up to these people's personalities. And, you know, Big Z was one of those guys. He was one of the best people that I'd ever played the game around.
That's good to hear.
Yeah.
That's good to hear. Good old Carl. Did he actually, I didn't really pay attention to what he did when he was there, but did he actually DH? And if so, how well did he hit?
I've never seen balls jump off a bat like that. Honestly.
Really?
He really could swing with the best of them.
I mean, I remember when he played, when he bat, I mean, it was like Big Z would come in and pinch hit when he played for the Cubs in big spots. So it was like, you knew he could hit.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it takes a special kind of athlete to be able to be a pitcher in the big leagues and still grab a bat and swing it.
Man, that's cool to hear. So now we're going to fast forward. The season ends. Now it's like, all right, it's the off season. And you realize there are some you mentioned this earlier, that you knew you didn't get phone calls no matter how well you pitched in the American Association. You knew you sort of had to take matters into your own hands. So walk us through the strategy that you were like, all right, I've got to have a plan. So how did you develop the plan? And what happened kind of leading up from the end of the season with the Dogs up until the moment the Rays call?
So one of the things I always didn't really that I didn't really like about my whole pitching process was, no matter what drills I did, I wasn't very good with using my legs. And there's two things that were always going to be my biggest vice. The first one was, I never knew how to use my legs. And two, I just never took care of myself nutritionally the way that other athletes did. And going into that off season, at the end of the season, I realized I had to make a change. And I just noticed that there was this app out that there was this account that a lot of collegiate baseball players were using called Flatground. And, you know, I watched all these kids posting their own videos, trying to get signs at schools and look for opportunities to play baseball. And I noticed this one guy, Nick Sinzeri, and I just realized I haven't said his name out loud until this moment. So I hope I said his last name right. But, I noticed that he was putting out pitching drills for everybody. And I just kind of realized, like, this guy's giving out free information. He's helping other athletes be the best versions of themselves. Maybe I need to show a little humility here. Forget the fact that I played professional baseball for the last 6 or 7 years and ask for help. And I reached out to him. I DM'd him on Twitter and I said, like, hey, listen, I don't think I use my legs very well. Here's my background. Here's a short video of me pitching in Lincoln. And do you think there's anything there that I can work on? And just to kind of paraphrase what he had said, he basically told me that I sucked at using my legs, and that if I had learned to actually use my legs the right way, that I'd probably gain 6 miles an hour. And my first thought was, that's such a bold claim. Like, that's got to be a marketing strategy. And then in the back of my mind, I thought, if there's a 1% chance that is even true, that's the difference between me being a fringe player of even getting back to professional baseball to having all the opportunities in the world presented. And I took that 1% chance. And every drill that he gave me, everything that I did, I had a video camera running at all times. I bought a pocket radar. I tethered the miles per hour to every video. And for hours, I mean, probably for 1 to 2 hours, every time I threw, I would take 2 or 3 videos of me throwing, stop, rewatch them, delete them, and go again until I felt like it was right. And I kind of obsessed over this process. And Nick and I talked every single day. We've probably talked every day for the last 6 or 7 months. And he would always give me feedback on my videos and help me out and tell me what I'm missing, what I need to work on, what are some drills I can do to continue working on that. And finally, about 8 or 9 weeks into it, I threw my first bullpen where normally I'd be 87 to 90, and I didn't throw a pitch under 95.
Wow.
And that's when I realized, like, yep, he was right. It's working. You know, I need to stick to this process. And at that point, I completely bought in. I got addicted to the process of working on my legwork. And before I knew it, I was getting opportunities to get back into affiliated baseball.
So here's where that being an analytical guy really helps out.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you mentioned using your legs. Nick helped you use your legs. Was right. there any sort of like, was it a matter of strengthening your legs, or is it just a matter of getting them all to work, getting that whole, like, you know, kinetic chain, if you will, working together?
I think it was a couple of things. I think the first thing was, I think strength wise, I'd always been, you know, I would never say elite, but enough to be able to handle it. My biggest problem was I was about 265 pounds at the time. And I always thought the old saying of mass equals gas. But what I realized was I didn't know how to move with that kind of weight on my body. So I started trying to eat better. I joined Weight Watchers, and that worked incredibly well. And after I lost about 20 pounds, I started to notice how well I was starting to move. I felt kind of fast when I was running. I felt explosive when I was on the mound. And I just realized that I took off the weighted vest and everything got better.
So there's so much. So you joined Weight Watchers.
Correct.
One, they should probably know that, and they should probably have you on a freaking commercial, man. I mean, that's have you ever said that publicly? I didn't read that anywhere.
I did say it. I think I said it publicly in one or two interviews, but I don't think it ever got scripted or written.
Well, what we've all said here, minus the part where we got disconnected, it's all there, man. Like, it's going to be out there. So Weight Watchers, that's crazy. I mean, I'm familiar with Weight Watchers in the sense that basically it's just about portion control, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a point system that allows you to understand which foods are, you know, kind of optimal for what you're trying to accomplish or not. And I think the biggest thing for me being on that program was I was eating a lot of foods that I thought were good for me and good for athletes and energy. And turns out I couldn't have been more dead wrong.
Wow. That's,
so there's,
that's awesome.
I kind of had to recalibrate my entire eating system.
Are you still a part of the program?
Yeah, I still do it. I still have the app on my phone. I haven't had a chance to really go into the studios. I went once or twice to talk to a consultant about it, but
yeah,
I still use the app.
I think that's awesome. Now, you've used Nick. Now, you said you talked to Nick every day for 6 months. Now that you're in Ray's camp, are you still talking to Nick, or is it more relying on the Rays pitching coaches?
Well, I'm talking to the Rays coaches every day, but I still text Nick every day as well. You know, like I said, I've become completely obsessive over this process. And, you know, I want to do whatever I can to be the best form of myself to help out the Tampa Bay Rays organization. And, you know, they've been extremely, not just communicative, but understanding. And I mean, from the first day that I've gotten here, they have been on board with everything that I've been doing. They've been helping me in every way possible. And honestly, it's been incredible so far.
How about from the, on the, I can't, hard for me to say apparently, how about on the nutrition side, how have they been for you?
They've been fantastic as well. They actually do a really good job with the food that they bring to the table. They understand that a lot of athletes have sweet tooths and, or sorry, sweet teeth, whatever. You know, I have a sweet tooth myself. But they realize that with other athletes, and they find a lot of ways to be really accommodating. Like, I know they have an entire snack bar where it's like beef jerky and turkey jerky, and they have a bunch of different types of chips, but they're not potato chips. They're like made from black beans, or they're grain-free chips, like gluten-free, you know, things like that. So like, they find ways to accommodate athletes without us feeling like we're sacrificing our nutritional needs.
How many vegan athletes are there? And are there any guys who are vegan?
I don't think I've ever met a truly vegan baseball player.
Yeah.
I've met a couple of vegetarians, but I don't think I've ever seen like a full-blown vegan baseball player.
Being a vegan is hard.
It's got to be extremely challenging.
My wife over the last month and a half has tried, but it's like, it's almost like goes like, you know, a week of, yeah, I'm a vegan and totally vegan. And then it's like, okay, now she just calls herself a flexitarian, which means I'll be a vegan when I want, but there's some days I just want to eat meat or, you know, whatever, or I want to have scrambled eggs for breakfast or whatever it is.
Oh, I totally get that. Lexi and I have had that conversation. I remember one time she was telling me that she wanted to be a vegetarian, but like sometimes a vegetarian. And I remember making a joke saying it's a, you know, you don't get to pick that. Like, it's not, you get to choose your battles. You're either vegetarian or you're not.
I will say this. I've gone two or three straight days of vegan. Well, not vegan, pescatarian, which is I'll still eat eggs.
Okay.
And I'll tell you what, I generally feel better. Like,
well, yeah, right, I think there's something to be said about those nutritional diets. Yeah. I think any time that you're cutting anything that your body doesn't know how to process, I think it's going to be beneficial.
So the last part of your transformation and signing with the Rays that we haven't covered is, you mentioned Flat Ground app. So Rob posts the video or retweets your video. How long does it take from the moment he retweets it to the moment that you start getting phone calls?
So the day that I threw like my personal record bullpen, I'd show Nick to that right away. Nick tweeted that out. And then I think within like 10 or 15 minutes, I saw that Rob Friedman had liked it and then retweeted it. And it went from having like 1,000 views to 20,000 to 50,000. And then I think by the end of 2 hours, it was at like 100,000 views or something.
Oh my gosh.
And within an hour or two, I probably had 3 or 4 phone calls from teams saying they wanted to come watch my next bullpen. And things really started taking off from that moment.
So in some of your videos, you grunt when you throw.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In those situations, I was trying to kind of test my own limits because I'd never really did that in the off season before. And
yeah,
understanding that last off season was a bit of a training modality, I really wanted to push myself and see what I was capable of. And it helped me a lot because now when I go into kind of a competing version of all of this, I mean, I grunt, but probably not to that extreme level that I did in that video. But it definitely taught me how to be more violent in my delivery. And yeah, I think it really helped me out.
Well, I mean, Max Scherzer grunts. I mean, that dude's about as intimidating as it gets. I like it.
I would agree with that.
When I watched the videos, I heard the grunting and I was like, hell yeah, I like that. Give me more of that.
I caught myself doing it a couple of times in my first game yesterday, and I don't think that's going to go anywhere. I want to bring that level of intensity every time I pitch now.
That's great. Well, now, with grunting, you have to have some pipes to really grunt. And I know you've got some pipes because, man, you've got your own single out there and you've got a band and the whole thing. That we haven't talked about that. It came up for a second when you talked about building a guitar for Chase Darno, which Chase is like a whole other topic that I could go down, but I'm not going to here.
But
guitars, playing guitar, being in a band, being a front man for a band, like that's not just a thing you do casually. That's like a real serious thing for you.
Yeah. So I've done it for a few years, you know, with my friends, Vince and Dave. We play in a band called Weeknight Syndicate. We've been working a lot on a lot of music and we're actually looking forward to releasing it here in the next month or two, of a full demo, like an 8-song demo. And, yeah, it's something that I've always been very passionate about music from a young age, but I came across these guys. We became friends and started writing music, and it went from just writing to kind of putting it out there. And, you know, we're really excited about all of it.
Are you a big grunge guy?
I do like grunge a lot. I am stuck in the 90s. I'm a big 90s alternative fan, but I also grew up listening to a lot of like Nirvana, Stone Temple Pilots, Collective Soul, things like that.
I hear that in your songs, in your voice. I can hear it.
Thank you. I appreciate that. That's 100% what I was going for.
That's awesome. Yeah, I hear it. And it's like, oh, these guys, I mean, obviously it's new music, but these guys could have played in the 90s for sure.
Well, I definitely would love to bring that type of music back. I miss that kind of music.
You know, what's funny is I sit in my office and, you know, I'm doing work or prepping for a podcast or whatever, and I'll put music on and I'll go to Amazon and I'll put like new alternative music and I'll listen to it and I'll end up like skipping like five or six songs, like 20 seconds into a song that I skip. And I'm like, nah, this isn't alternative. This is like very different. So maybe that's why it's alternative. But when I hear alternative, I think of all the bands that you just mentioned.
Yeah, I feel like alternative has become such a very broad genre, unfortunately. But I mean, for me, whenever someone says alternative music, my first initial thought is Audioslave.
Yes.
You know, Stone Temple Pilots, like even Pearl Jam, I even kind of think of them as a little bit alternative rock.
For sure.
That's the genre I prefer.
I don't know if you have XM, but Lithium.
Lithium? With Nirvana?
Well, no. So XM Radio, one of the stations, is called Lithium.
Oh, yeah. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, and it's basically all just like 90s alternative and rock. And there's some other stuff that gets mixed in there. But yeah, I listen to that, and it takes me back to middle school and high school because that's where I was in the 90s.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, great time to be alive.
Yeah, no doubt. So, hey, there's an alternative band. Well, ish. They're more poppy, but they had some grunge to them, no doubt. Anyway, so have you guys played? Have you performed? Or is it more like, for now, it's a studio band?
It's been a studio band, but we do have full intentions of playing shows once we get the stuff out there. The approach that we've kind of taken to all of it was, in order for us to be booked at anywhere of a semi-serious venue, we need to have semi-serious recordings.
Yeah.
So, you know, we didn't want to like be showing people what we're capable of off of our phones. We wanted to be able to say like, hey, listen, Spotify, Amazon, you know, Pandora, whatever. You can search on these different media sources and you'll be able to listen to us. That way we have a little bit more credibility. And
totally.
From there, we can be taken a little more seriously.
So have you ever performed live in front of people?
I have, yeah. I actually have. The first time I ever performed outside of my dorm room was actually, we did this thing where for the Gopher athletes, we had like this talent show where basically we wanted to showcase the fact that athletes aren't just simply athletes. We do things outside of sport. And a girl that was on the tennis team had asked me if I would play in it. And I said, you know what, sure, why not? I ended up playing a song completely outside of my own genre. I played Wanted by Hunter Hayes. And when I got up on that bar stool with a microphone and the lights kind of came down, I had realized, you know, this wasn't just 1,500 people. These were my classmates, my teammates, coaches, you know, front office staff. And I just remember thinking how nervous I was. But as soon as I got through that first 5 or 10 seconds, I just remember having the time of my life singing and playing in front of them. And that's when I kind of realized, like, I could see myself doing this, even if it's just recreational or just for fun. It would be so much fun to perform again.
Nice. So have you performed outside of that? Have you performed before?
Nothing major. There was a restaurant or a bar area back towards my hometown called Kudas, where they used to have this open mic on Tuesday nights. But it wasn't just like a bring guitar and sing, like there'd also be bassists and drummers. And we would literally get kind of hodgepodge together and put into these groups. And then we would play these songs. I'd always go there and play like Matchbox 20.
Nice. Nice. Yeah. You know, it's funny. Every once in a while, I go back to that. I can't think of the name of the album. Whatever, Push and 3 a.m. Every once in a while.
Yeah.
I'll just like, well, I guess I don't put the CD in anymore, but go to Amazon and play it. If I want a car ride, and it's like, it always takes me back, man. I just love listening to that album.
It is a great album. I still listen to that one to this day. I would say Matchbox 20 is probably in my top five for most frequently played bands.
Oh, that's cool. So you're at spring training now. You're down in Port Charlotte. Where is Gator?
Oh, he's being watched by one of our neighbors at the apartment, Debbie. And if she's hearing this, huge shout out. Thank you so much for watching Gator for us.
Now, is Gator with you in Florida or is he back home?
He's back home right now.
Okay. Now, and home, you're still in school, right? You're still trying to get your degree. So is that in Minneapolis or is this in Chicago area?
Yes, we moved into an apartment in North Loop, Minneapolis.
Okay.
So just over the bridge, like right in the heart of downtown.
Yeah. All right. Good. Well, I couldn't help but notice Gator. I posted a picture of my dog on Instagram. I realized I never post pictures of my dog anywhere on social media. Like people probably don't even know I have a dog. But I walked into my room yesterday and she was laying down and looked super cute. And my hat was laying on the chair next to her. So I just put my turnip pair baseball hat on top of her and she didn't even move. And I took a picture and said, there's my co-host right there.
That's really funny. That's like the polar opposite with Lexi. Lexi will, I'm pretty sure if people ask, they're pretty sure that she doesn't have an Instagram, but our dog has one.
Nice.
It's mostly pictures of Gator. So
nice. Yeah. You know, it's funny. Yeah. My dog was like it, right? This is before my dog now. And then I had kids and then it switches. Then it's like kids become the thing that you're posting pictures of. And the dog
of course. That makes total sense.
The dog is there and she feels all the love in the world, but she doesn't get broadcast out to the world as much as the kids do.
And that's fair. That's to be expected.
Yeah. Yeah. But she definitely feels the love for sure. My kids. Yeah. They especially my kids. I think that's the whole great thing about having a dog with kids is like my kids adore my dog. Like if she's laying on the floor, they'll just like get on the floor and like spoon her. And she just, you can almost see the smile on her face when they do it. It's great.
Oh, that's great.
So you've accomplished quite a bit in baseball. Obviously we know that there's so much more that you want to accomplish. What is the next big baseball milestone for you?
I think the next biggest milestone is going to be getting back to the big leagues and just being able to stay consistent with competing up there. I think there's a large paradigm shift when you make your debut because your whole goal your entire life was to become a big league pitcher. But once you get there, everything changes. It then becomes, you know, trying to have the longevity of a major league baseball player. And a lot of people don't realize that it's not that easy. The game changes a lot when you get up there. The tools that other athletes have, the ability to work and adapt and all the advanced scouting reports and being able to, you know, not just play the game, but it almost becomes a game of chess because you start to not only face these athletes, but you learn everything about them from what their pickoff move is like to the quality of their secondary stuff. And, it then becomes a matter of can you constantly adapt and be able to perform at the highest level?
Absolutely. You know, you bring up a great point. I think there's the term sophomore slump.
And I know. Yep, absolutely.
I think my theory on that is that it's not that people have a good first year and then that second year they take it easy. It's that there's so much data, to your point, there's so much data out there. There's a million cameras throughout the stadium that you can break down every little nuance of every little movement you make and people figure out your weaknesses. They figure out your tendencies and everyone else is adapting to you and sharing data, right? And collectively figuring out how to beat you. And then you have to figure out how to collectively beat everyone else back and kind of readjust. And I think that's where that sophomore slump comes in is people sort of figure you out and it's how fast can you figure everyone else out, right? The counterpunch, the chess move, what's the next move? So yeah,
absolutely. It's a pendulum, you know, it constantly goes back and forth. And the guys that are the greatest at this game are the ones that realize that and they're able to quickly make those adjustments in the moment rather than, you know, have the results dictate whether or not they need to change.
Absolutely. Well, we've gone through a ton here. Let's go through a couple quick rapid fire questions here before we wrap this thing up. We talked food. Now, we don't want to overindulge on the food, but I know you like Mexican food. So is it a burrito or a bowl?
Bowl.
What's your biggest pet peeve?
Holding the door for somebody and they end up either using the other door or not saying thank you.
Oh, my gosh. The not saying thank you thing? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that kills me.
Or when you're at an intersection and you wave someone. And all you just give me a nod, whatever. But when they just like go and don't even
when they just carry on through, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't have space for that.
That's so funny. I think that's like the Midwestern in us that expects the thank you because we're just so used to it. And when it doesn't happen, you're like, dude, what's your problem?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's so funny. What is your phobia?
Ooh. Biggest phobia. I don't like snakes. Definitely not a big fan of snakes.
So the Diamondbacks are out.
Well, it's a mascot. That's okay. But
yeah, I'm kidding. Yeah, I'm with you on the snake thing. Yeah, not a big fan. What's your walk-up song or your warm-up song?
Ooh, it changes year by year, but I had Audio Slave for a while. I actually had Creed for a couple of years as well. So I'm kind of back and forth on deciding what I want to do.
You know, you've got me wanting to go listen to Audio Slave. I haven't listened to Audio Slave like on purpose in a long time. And as soon as we're done here, I'm going to throw on some Audio Slave. It's been a while.
That's a great move. Don't forget Soundgarden.
Well, obviously, that was Audio Slave. I'm not Audio Slave before, but sort of became.
Yeah.
Went from Soundgarden to Audio Slave. All right. Two more questions.
Okay.
You have the option to play. Now, I think I know the answer. At least I think I know the answer you're going to give me versus hopefully. I don't know if that's the truth or not, but I'm going to ask it anyway. A record label says, listen, we love your demo. We love your music. We want you guys to go play a headline tour all across the country this summer. We're going to pay you a lot of money to do it. Or you spend all 162 games on the Rays roster. You have to pick one, and they both pay the same.
I would pick baseball, honestly, because your body only holds out for so long. And eventually, I mean, unfortunately, over time, it becomes increasingly hard to play this game as you get older. But music, you have your entire life.
Yeah, I mean, the Rolling Stones are like 170, and they're still selling out stadiums.
And they're still killing it out there. They're still doing it.
Yeah, yeah. Guys that are that age aren't like Hank Aaron isn't playing baseball, but the Rolling Stones are like Hank Aaron's age, and they're still selling out stadiums. So, yeah.
All right. Oh, absolutely.
Good answer. Good answer. I figured that was the answer you'd go with. If you said the other, the concert thing, I would have been surprised. But the last question I have, if you could relive one moment in your life again, what would it be?
If I had to relive one moment in my life, I guess it would probably be my big league debut, and that might be a very basic answer for me to give, but I mean, nothing will ever feel more paramount than working since you're 7 years old for a specific dream and then being able to attain it.
I think that's awesome. How cool would it be if you could press a button and literally go back in that moment and just relive that emotion again?
I would press it. I would definitely press it again.
Yeah, wear that button out.
Yeah, I definitely would break that button.
DJ, this has been a lot of fun. It's been a lot of fun, you know, connecting with you. And, you know, I did a bunch of research on you, but to actually hear you tell the story was so much cooler. And I certainly appreciate your time. We went a little bit over the time that I promised we would cover it within, but I certainly appreciate that. Is there anything that we missed?
I don't think so. Thank you so much for having me. Honestly, I had a great time too.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. I wish you the best of health and the best of success this spring and obviously into the summer with the Rays.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, subscribe now on iTunes, Spotify, Podomatic, Google Play, or Apple Play. If you'd like to hear more from the Turn a Pair Baseball podcast, go back in the archives and listen to any of our shows. Don't forget to leave us a 5-star review or great comments if you enjoyed the show. Also, go ahead and click that subscribe button so you can always know when we'll have our latest episodes out and available. We even like when you send us messages on Twitter with your thoughts on today's show or if you've got ideas for future guests. You can find us on Twitter at TurnaPairChris and on Instagram at TurnaPairBaseballPodcast. You can find our guest DJ on Twitter at DJ Snelton and on Instagram at Snelt003. So that's SNELT003. Go give him a follow. Turn a Pair Baseball Podcast is written, hosted, edited, and produced by me, Chris McClain. I'd like to thank DJ for joining the show, but most importantly, I'd like to thank you for listening.